Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Issue 45. Ben Stark of Wonder Mill Films. Craig Hamilton of CitizenCraig.com.
Craig, how are you?
Good, how about you?
Very good. So, as part of the Shelf of Shame project, my personal Shelf of Shame project, I was supposed to watch On the Waterfront in, like, April. I had never seen it before, and it was a goal of mine to, in the Shelf of Shame, I assign every month a movie I've never seen before, a classic movie or a well-regarded movie that I've never seen, and I try to watch it. And it's been a pretty busy year for me, so I've been pretty far behind. So finally I caught up with, I believe it was my April or May title, and it was Elia Kazan's On the Waterfront. I haven't ever seen a Kazan movie. Haven't seen that. Yeah, never ever. I haven't seen that many Marlon Brando movies. So I know this is a super highly regarded. It's a big in terms of like socially relevant Hollywood cinema, and also in terms of like method acting. There's a lot of touchstones here. So I can see why it's important. I've watched it for the first time on Friday night. And you being a fan of classic Hollywood film, I thought, and I believe a fan of this movie, I thought you'd be a good person to talk to about it.
Oh, yeah. Well, thanks for thinking of me.
Of course. So this movie's pretty great.
Yeah. It's not in my top 10 of all time.
Right.
But whenever I do watch it, or whenever I just sit back and think about it, it makes me question that, you know.
Really?
Like,
okay.
Because I love Elia Kazan, and the acting that Brando does. You know, you see Marlon Brando, and there's a scene I think we've sort of touched on via text. There's a scene that's almost become like a cliche.
Absolutely.
In this movie. And Marlon Brando himself, I think, has at times at this point become a cliche. But when you watch him really do his thing here. I mean, you got Carl Malden and Rod Steiger with him and DJ Cobb, but I don't want to say he acts circles around him, but they compliment him very well. Like,
yeah,
he just owns it in this. Like you said, go ahead.
I was going to say there's, you know, that's kind of what I expected going in, was like, this is going to be the Marlon Brando show. But then, of course, as soon as Carl Malden showed up, I was like, oh yeah, here we go. And, you know, I kind of have to think that maybe I'm not as familiar with the other work of Malden and J. Lee Cobb, but or Lee J. Cobb. I always get him confused with J. Lee Thompson, the director of Conquest of the Planet of the Apes. So I don't know if maybe Brando brought out the ferocity in them, but, you know, I mean, 12 Angry Men and on one side, and Birdman of Alcatraz and Patton on the other. Carl Malden and Cobb, they're pretty great in this. If they're not necessarily that same kind of, like, you know, internal struggle actor, performer that Marlon Brando is here, but they hold their own, and they're pretty great. From the opening, you know, frames of their individual introductory scenes, you know, they are, as they are in the other movies that I've seen them in, just extremely watchable and so capable and so great.
Lee J. Cobb comes off the screen, I think. I think he's such an imposing figure in this.
Yeah.
That it's almost like, you know, his character is in 3D almost.
Yeah.
Rod Steiger being his, you know, right-hand man, his sort of this kind of, his performance is more a quiet sort of facial, especially in that, the back of that car scene. He's got some lines there, but when Brando takes over, you see Charlie, that's his name, right?
You see,
and he's just kind of sitting there taking this on. It's just as important to the Charlie character how he responds to it, because it's some heavy stuff that Brando's saying to him, and the way he kind of acts as he's hearing it is like just as strong.
Yeah, actually, I read earlier today that Brando demanded that his scenes be his angle on that scene be shot first, and then when it came time to shoot Rod Steiger's angle, Brando left. So he basically, Steiger had to react to a performance that had already been captured without the other actor in the scene. So he actually used that frustration to play those reactions, and I think that it helps the scene. You know, it's one of those scenes that, you know, I've heard it 1,000 times. I've heard about it, and it's basically kind of replayed in Raging Bull at the end. So I've always kind of known it through culture. So I was excited to see it for the first time, and I didn't realize until I kind of, until the speech started that I was in that scene, because it is so, you know, it's not this giant climactic moment. It is really this quiet, revelatory scene in the movie that lets you know, lets you see this character as kind of almost self-aware for the first time. And it really is quietly powerful. And it's one of those it's almost amazing to see it in context that it has become such a standout pop culture touchstone. Not because it's not a good scene, but because it is so organically, it doesn't stand out in the movie to me at all in terms
right.
of, it's not a contrast to the movie. You know, it's great because the movie is great, but it's not in contrast to really any other scene. I think there's several other tremendous scenes in the movie, several of which have nothing to do with dialogue and are just about directing, that I was kind of blown away by.
Yeah, I think it's just the caricature that Brando has now become or had became.
Yes, yeah.
And his, you know, the people's ability to impersonate him,
yeah.
And to kind of just blow that whole contender thing out of proportion, and that's all you hear. If you never see the movie, that's all you hear, but you see it in context of the film, and like you said, it's seamless. It's not a big jump from that. It's not a standout necessarily scene, but when you get that and Bernstein's score behind it, you get Charlie saying, hey, you know, we helped you out. He's like, no, you actually ruined my life. And, and I think the Brando character isn't saying, you know, I could have been the champion, which is what you get if you only hear the impersonations. He's actually saying, I could have been a good person.
Right.
I could have had some dignity and some integrity, but you've sucked that completely out of me.
Yeah, like, I did okay in the mud, but I could have thrived. You know, I did okay in the darkness, but I could have thrived in the light had you not interfered and kind of steered me the wrong way. It's really sad, and it's a really, especially where the movie kind of goes, and again, I mean, it's not the climax of the movie. There's a huge last act in the movie after that. And where it goes just makes it even more sad because, it's not that Marlon Brando's character like dies or anything, but he gets redemption, but it is at, you know, it's a martyr's redemption almost. He has to go through so much more to get there, to escape where his brother put him, you know. He has to dig his way out, and once he digs his way out, it's still not that pretty. You know, it's not like he ever reaches any sort of, you know, glorious mountaintop.
Right.
You bring up the Bernstein score, and honestly, that is one of my sticking points. If I have to pick out any, which I don't have to pick out any, but it is something that kind of stood out to me a few times. There's a few scenes where it kind of overtook the dialogue for me, and I think one of those scenes is when Marlon Brando goes to Ava Marie Saint's apartment and kind of like, you know, confesses his feelings for her and kind of forces a kiss on her that, you know, people nowadays would probably kind of call the scene rapey, but I don't know if it's because the the producers felt that tension a little too much in the scene, so they wanted to layer music up to kind of play up the emotion rather than the kind of realistic tension in it. There was something about the score in that scene that was kind of overwhelming, and there's a few moments where in the beginning of the movie, again, what I was expecting was this quiet social justice picture, you know, but right out of the gate, you get this really bombastic score, and it's great, and it lets you know that, hey, look, this is a movie about ordinary people in, you know, slightly extraordinary situations, but it's still important, and it's big, and this music is going to let you know that. So I appreciate that, but I do feel like that there's some scenes, and that's the only one that I can really pull out with any kind of specificity, but I feel like there's a few scenes that it's so much there that it bullied the quiet dialogue going on underneath it.
Did it kind of Nolan the dialogue?
yeah, there's a Zimmer Nolan kind of thing there where it's like, pay attention to this! You know, it's just super, super intense. But you know, it's really hard to complain about an otherwise fantastic score. The one scene that I really wanted to kind of highlight, and I mentioned earlier, that it's a great scene, and it's done. The reason it's great is specifically because it does what it does without dialogue. And that's the scene where he confesses his complicity in the death of Ava Marie Saint's brother's character to her. And it's done at the behest of Carl Malden's priest. And he's like looking through this, it kind of starts at this fence above the waterfront area. And then Brando goes down and confronts her, and Malden kind of sees it play out. And you hear nothing but, like, the barges making noise in there, and Brando and Saint are trying to communicate with each other over the noise. But because of the movie that's come before that, you see all of that tension, and you see all of that release without ever really hearing what they're saying to each other. And that was the moment where I was like, oh, man, this isn't just this character drama. You know, this is great cinema. This is a director knowing when to use the right tools to for the right purposes.
And this guy, you know, I just love him. And I kind of compare him, I don't compare him, I think there's some similarities between him and Sidney Lumet. In that, I watch his movies and I'm like, especially his later ones. And I'm like, he had to have a reason for every little thing. Like, nothing was a coincidence. Nothing just was by accident. He kept it in and it was cool, which there probably were. But it just seems like this guy was so smart and knew what he was doing that it just, even the loud score, like, I'm like, you know, that's annoying. But maybe he did that on purpose for some reason.
Exactly.
As you mentioned, but. Well, that's and it's full of that stuff. And, you know, I read somewhere that it's speculated that this was Kazan's answer to the criticism for him kind of identifying a former communist to the authorities or what have you.
Right, right.
So, and this is kind of, it's a similar theme as far as, you know, ratting people out, I guess, but, And the writer, Bud Schulberg, also kind of did the same thing to people.
Okay.
See,
I knew about the Kazan thing, but I didn't know. I knew about the Kazan, kind of the greater metaphor there, but I didn't know about the writer.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, and I didn't know much about him either. I was just kind of reading up on it. But apparently, they did so much research on this. Like, it's based on, like, loosely based on a true story. Not loose enough to where the person it was based on couldn't sue and get a bunch of money later. But apparently the screenwriter sat in on these trials, on these waterfront commission trials, and knew the priest. And then wrote this script, and then the studio was sued for money and had to pay it. But anyways,
fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and that's see, I could totally see that because it is such a and there is a, it's not procedural necessarily, but there is kind of a procedural feeling to it, you know, where it kind of goes through all the different steps of whistleblowing, and I you know, again, it's one of those things I never knew. I thought it was more of a gangster. It was going to be more of a gangster movie, but no, it, you know, there's a courtroom aspect to this movie that I didn't see coming. So yeah, I could totally. I never knew it was based on a real thing, but I can totally see that in the kind of fiber of the movie.
Yeah, I think also its reception was like, you know, it got like 12 nominations and won Best Picture, and he won Best Director, and this was like immediately following the, what he did.
Huh.
And that's always kind of fascinating to me that he was immediately sort of welcomed back into the fold,
right,
if you will, following that, which, you know, you could argue that was a good or bad decision, I guess, but, you know, it's Hollywood, so that those aren't, that's not the, always the most forgiving section of the country. But, yeah, it's just kind of fascinating to me that all these things sort of happened at once.
Yeah, and it's, yeah, I mean, I guess being an optimist, it's encouraging to me to see that they saw, you know, a great directing job for what it was and were willing to award it despite, you know, despite Kazan making plenty of enemies.
Right.
Through what he did.
Very true. So what else stands out about this to you?
I mean, the again, Kazan is a director. Brando stood out, but yeah, I'll admit I had a lot of trouble kind of seeing, you know, seeing his performance for what it was, and not seeing his performance through the lens of, you know, Don Corleone or Jor-El from Superman the movie. There's that Brando figure looms so large over all his work. But it didn't take long for it to go away, and I again, that Raging Bull connection, I think that helped a lot. There's so much there of living as an animal, you know, instead of living like a man and surviving rather than flourishing. There's a lot of that dialogue that clearly informed Raging Bull that gave me the ability to kind of see it for what it was, and I love that. So it was a discovery for me, for Kazan, for Brando. It was another great Carl Malden performance, and that the priest character in general is just this wonderful example of this a cinematic arc. You know, like that character, you from his first scene, you see him learn something new, and then in terms of he sees that, okay, you know, he can't just be a priest in the church. He needs to step out and be a part of the community. And from that decision and seeing the negative consequence of not stepping up earlier, you know, there's the death of this teenage boy, there's, you know, from that decision, his whole story arc starts, and he brings it to completion at the end by kind of guiding Brando to, you know, to lead the workers. So just that care, and he's not, it's just a wonderful example of a character that is complex and is conflicted, but isn't, you know, doesn't necessarily have a visible dark side. You know, it reminds me of the Daniel Day-Lewis's Lincoln. You know, it's this character that is complex and able to inspire good in others, and, you know, has moral struggles, but is not, you know, a bad person, or does not give into the darker aspects of his natural personality. It's just one of those things where so often lazy screenwriting or lazy film writing will
right.
assume that, look, if I make this person bad, then he's interesting and complex, and
right.
good people are boring. But this is a great example of somebody that's complex, that's conflicted, but that is good, and that inspires good in other people through the way that he deals with his conflict and his complexity. So I just love Malden. I mean, he just as a screen presence, he's just awesome, and I think he's slowly, you know, cementing his place in like my top 10 favorite character actors ever. He's just so good.
That's well put, and I thought it was an interesting choice, but it worked well to give him a prosthetic nose.
Yeah, the proto Owen Wilson. Yeah, proto Owen Wilson.
Just a ball on the end of it there. Really.
Yeah, it's impossible not to look at, but for some reason it totally worked, and it's disarming in a way, you know. And it's like, I don't know, you just feel like, I could tell this guy anything because of his giant nose. So overall, I was totally enraptured in on the same level as another Shelf of Shame movie this year, by a director that you mentioned, who I agree has a lot in common with Kazan. I watched The Verdict for the first time this year, Sidney Lumet's The Verdict. And it's amazing. It's a masterpiece. And it's in the same kind of genre of a social justice drama that is almost structured like a thriller, you know, that has this redemption storyline at the center of it. And it's so satisfying to see these kind of movies. Also, last year I watched The Bicycle Thieves for the first time, the Vittoria De Sica movie. And I think they're all of the same kind of family of movies that are, they're character-based, they're, you know, they address social injustice and failure of society at large and stories ripped from the headlines, but they're not boring. You know, they've got a plot, they've got a dynamic to them that propels them forward, that, you know, it doesn't make it just, you know, the typical neo-realist exercise or something like that. And there's a directorial hand, you know? I mean, again, like Kazan, he makes a clear decision with every scene that he shoots, and the same goes for Lumet and De Sica too. And so I've had a really good time kind of watching these kind of movies. And honestly, they're not in the kind of movies that if I just, you know, turn on the TV, I'm going to choose to watch, you know? I'm right. Usually going to gravitate towards something of genre or an action movie or something like that. But these are in their way, you know, just as enthralling as any Jackie Chan or Arnold Schwarzenegger movie.
That's kind of what I was saying at the beginning. It's like, you know, when I think of my favorite movies, On the Waterfront is not one that comes to mind immediately. But just giving a little thought and thinking back, and or even watching it again, and it's like, oh wait, there's so much depth here. It's not just a few standout things, or it's not that I just didn't emotionally connect with it, but that when I see it again, it kind of jumps back up there, and I'm like, wait, this is a great film because, like you said, the directing and the writing and kind of the framing of the theme as a whole, and then, you know, the acting, there's just so much there. And, yeah, it won a ton of awards, and it is one of the, you know, people talk about it all the time, but on a personal level, for some reason, I need to be reminded of it to, you know, begin to think about it.
Yeah, and that kid that kills all the pigeons totally needs a stunner. I mean, what a jerk.
I wonder if pigeon farming, is that like a thing, or... Like, do all boxers do that? Because I know Mike Tyson did that when he was young. I don't know if it's like a thing in that city or.
Yeah,
you know?
I can only assume it's maybe like, you know, people that live out in the country that have pet squirrels. Maybe, I don't know. They're so plentiful that all you can do is use them as a pet. I don't know.
So let me ask you. Okay, so did you know that there is a Vatican's list of 45 greatest films?
No.
Yeah, there is one. And
okay.
And they put it together in 1995. And this film is on there, but it's devised by sections. And in the values section lies on the waterfront.
Huh.
It is in no order. There are 45 greatest films, and there is a values section and on the waterfront in that section. And the 2007 version of the AFI list is number 19.
Yeah.
But I double-checked this on several different sites. So, you know, the Sight and Sound poll, it, you know, was renewed back in 2012.
Right.
You know, I couldn't find it.
Really?
I couldn't find it on the top one. Yeah. So this is a call for anyone listening. Find it for me. I couldn't find it. I did Control F on about three different websites, and I couldn't find it in the top 100. So then what I did was I went to the top 250, and I could not find it.
Oh, it's got to be in there somewhere then. I mean, there's.
I Googled, quote, on the, end quote. Then I Googled, quote, water, quote.
Uh-huh.
End quote.
Well, maybe it was searching for waterfront, all one word.
But I just said water.
Right, but I don't know. Look, I mean, we'll have to discuss this further on SEO Nerds Unlimited. But I think that, yeah, there's got to be something going on because I can't imagine this movie slipping from. I mean, that's why it was on my shelf of shame because I knew it was on so many, you know, top 100 and top 250 lists. So,
right.
Yeah, there's something.
And I think number 19 is kind of low, actually. But anyways, I thought that was weird.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't want to, for me, I don't want to overstate, like, I don't know if this is, like, if this would crack my top 100. I definitely, I'll go, this was not going to crack my top 100. Upon further re-watches, it may grow in estimation. Because there were elements that I was floored by, but overall, I don't know if I would call it like an A-plus perfect movie. But yeah, I can totally understand why it was on all those lists and why it's so regarded. And I'm very excited to see more of Kazan's work. And I also understand why it won Best Director. Did it also win Best Picture?
Yeah.
Okay. So it won Best Picture over, we've talked about 1954, I feel like.
Yeah, 1954 was not a strong year.
Okay.
There was this other movie called The Country Girl.
Right.
That I actually really liked. Just give me a second, I can find it. The other movies of that year, I should have this ready. I hope you're ready to edit this out.
No, I might even leave it in, but I can vamp. Or
okay. Yeah, let's vamp. We're vamping. We're vamping.
Vamping now while you looked it up.
We're vaping.
I can't remember if 1954, if Rear Window was nominated that year, but.
No, it was not.
That's crazy.
It was
I can't possibly rank On the Waterfront over Rear Window because that's just one of my favorite movies of all time. Just personally also, that year also had Seven Samurai and The Seventh Seal, I believe. That's such a strong year. But, yeah, I think we talked about before that the Oscars, it was kind of a weaker year. It is – one of those things where I totally, you know, if it was up against Rear Window, I can see why this needs to win. You know, it says a little bit more about
Rear Window is not.
Right, right.
Not
I'm just saying if I had to pit their best picture versus my best picture of the year.
Oh, I got you.
I would understand why somebody would say On the Waterfront because of its importance, you know, from not just culture at large, but also Hollywood culture and what was going on there at the time.
So you got On the Waterfront Run, obviously, the other nominations that are good, The Country Girl is actually really good. Grace Kelly won Best Picture for that. And you got Bing
Crosby. Her entire identity won Best Picture.
Best Actress. Yeah, and Bing Crosby was in that as well. That's one of those movies that I'd never even heard of that I watched because I was watching all those nominees and was like, wow, that's a really good movie. So The Country Girl is good. The Caine Mutiny is also really good. Humphrey Bogart plays like a naval captain that just loses it. And then you've got Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, which makes me want to gouge my eyes out. And
I believe that's one of my wife's favorite movies of all time.
Yeah, same here. Right. Three Coins in a Fountain was the other movie. And I just have to say that is one of the worst movies of all the Best Picture nominees ever that I've seen from 1950 to 1979. It's awful, and it's a joke. So that got a nomination over Rear Window. So... And the only two similar nominees from director and picture were A Life is on the Waterfront and George Seton, The Country Girl. Those are the only two directors that had Best Picture nominees. So it was a really weird year.
Who are the other best director? If you haven't pulled up, who are the other best director nominees?
Hitchcock for Rear Window. William Wellman for The High and the Mighty.
Mm-hmm.
And Billy Wilder's Sabrina.
Oh, okay. That's one of the weaker Billy Wilder movies, I would think. Mm-hmm. But I mean, again, Rear Window is that makes perfect sense. That's so much more of a Best Director movie than it is a Best Picture movie. So I guess my feelings aren't hurt too bad. But it's nice to know that the Academy always had their type, you know, and they've always kind of gone for that specific type of movie. What is The Three Pennies of Melquiades Estrades about?
So it's about these young women in Rome, and they're leaving. They're like secretaries, obviously, because they're women, and they're going to go home because they can't find a husband. So they throw a coin in a fountain. You know that famous Rome fountain? It says,
right.
You know, if you throw a coin in here, that means you'll come back someday or something like that, whatever. And they do that. The thing is, all three of them threw the coin in the fountain, if I remember correctly. I think it was only two of them. I could be wrong. But that immediately pissed me off because I was like, that's contradictory to the title. But anyways... And then, so they all end up finding a man, a rich old man to marry. And it's not tongue-in-cheek at all. It's completely serious.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it's the worst.
Wow. Well, you know, that's all they could hope for. That's, you know, at that point, I guess. Wow. That sounds horribly toothless and kind of reductive that it, now I'm equally irritated that Rear Window wasn't nominated.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, at least they picked the right winner.
You've got Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, or a bunch of dudes looking for wives. That's weird.
I mean, it was after World War II, and people wanted to hook up, you know, they came back from war, and they were working and building bombs and building weapons, and they needed to
ready
needed to
get
hook up.
Down.
Yeah, yeah, ready to get down to business. So what other Kazan movies would you recommend that you've seen, if you've seen any more?
Yes, I would recommend A Face in the Crowd, which is Andy Griffith.
Right, that's the one where he runs for, he's like an evil politician.
Yeah, it's...
Okay.
No, he's actually like a performer.
Okay.
And he's found in this jail because he's just like drunk and young and stupid, and they find him and they make him. It's actually so relevant to reality TV right now. It is incredibly relevant. And they put him in the spotlight, and he is famous. People love him. He's a horrible person, and he just like he kind of takes over and just burns out. Patricia Neal's in it. She's wonderful. That's a really good movie, and you know Andy Griffith is like one of my favorite probably people of all time, and to see him in this role is just like you're kind of I kind of realized, well, now he was a legitimately good actor because he's able to do this, but the rest of his career he only plays nice people, but
right.
So yeah, that Kazan, A Face in the Crowd, Gentleman's Agreement is not my favorite. But Gregory Peck's in that one. He's the lead in that one. It's very much kind of anti-Semitism in the late 40s. I just found it it's a little bit preachy. I completely agree with its sentiment and its message, and I thought otherwise it was a good movie. I just thought it was a little heavy-handed for me. A Streetcar Named Desire, obviously.
And right.
His other Brando one. East of Eden, I've seen. I'm not a huge fan of that, although when you talk about caricatures, when you kind of realize how great caricatures really are, that is like Brando. You see Brando and this, you're like, oh, wait, he wasn't just somebody people impersonate. He was an actually great actor. The same thing with James Dean. That dude was just, it's really a shame he's not alive anymore because, man, he was really awesome. Shame he didn't make more movies. Splendor in the Grass is really great. Natalie Wood and Warren Beatty, I believe. That's a sad one, but it's Natalie Wood's just awesome. And you kind of really like her a lot in that one, although she's got major issues. And then America, from 1963. That's the latest one I've seen. That's kind of a tough one. It's about like a Middle Eastern guy trying to get to America. So it's kind of like, you know, it was probably a very challenging movie to make. And I appreciate how he did that in the end product, but I couldn't really connect with it emotionally.
Is it cast accurately or is it like, you know,
oh, there's like no
American dude as a Middle Eastern dude.
Oh, no. Yeah, he casts it completely accurately, I believe.
Wow.
That's
awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not like Mickey Rooney as a Middle Eastern man.
I probably wouldn't have watched it if Mickey Rooney was in it. But, it's almost 3 hours and, you know.
Uh-huh. It's work.
Yeah.
Awesome, man. Well, thanks for talking to me about it, and look forward to seeing more Gilead Kazan, Marlon Brando, and Carl Malden movies.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
For more from the Film Nerds, go to filmnerds.com and aspectradioshow.com.
Okay, cool. I'll count us down. 3, 2, 3, 2, 1.